Angeles, where if you're engaged, it simply means you're publicly announcing that you are dating a person monogamously. I also became familiar with an entirely new category of people, the unhappily married person. They are everywhere, and they are 10,000 times more depressing than a divorced person. My friend Tim, whose name I've changed, obviously, has gotten more and more depressing since he married his girlfriend of 7 years. Tim is the kind of guy who corners you at a party to tell you vehemently that marriage is work, and that you have to work on it constantly, and that going to couples therapy is not only normal, but something that everyone needs to do. Tim has a kind of manic, culty look in his eye from paying thousands of dollars to a marriage counselor. He is convinced that his daily work on his marriage, and his acknowledgement that it is basically a living hell, is modern. The result is that he has helped relieve me of any romantic notions I had about marriage. What is fascinating to me is that divorced people tend to be the least depressing or depressed people I know. They're all unburdened and cleansed and the wiser for it. This is the case even if they didn't initiate the divorce. I have a comedy writer friend, Sandy, whose husband left her for another woman the moment his restaurant, which Sandy had invested in and made possible, became successful. It was kind of the worst story anyone had ever heard. A betrayal that, had it been me, I would have driven slowly around downtown Los Angeles at night in my car, with my windows rolled down, trying to solicit a hitman to murder my husband. After 6 months of hardship and going to therapy 3 times a week, Sandy's now elated. She realized, as almost everyone I know who has been left or broken up with, that, by divorcing her, her husband had relieved her of the job of eventually leaving him. As my mom has said, when one person is unhappy, it usually means two people are unhappy, but that one has not come to terms with it yet. Sandy hadn't realized how unhappy she was until he was gone. She told me that her husband's leaving her was one of the nicest gifts he ever gave her, because she would never have seen it clearly enough to do it herself. It's not easy, of course. They have kids, and coordinating and sharing them is a hassle and a heartbreak, but she's still better off than she was before. A couple of great marriages. My parents get along because they are pals. They're not big on analyzing their relationship. What do I mean by pals? It mostly means that they want to talk about the same stuff all the time. In my parents' case, it's essentially rose plants, mulch, and the placement of shrubs. They love gardening. They can talk about aphids the way that I can talk about New York Fashion Week. They can spend the entire day talking nonstop about gladiolas and men of a certain age, watch Piers Morgan, and then share a vanilla milkshake and go to bed. They're pals. No, they're pals, not best friends. My mom's best friend is her sister. A best friend is someone you can talk to ad nauseam about feelings, clothing, gossip, etc. My dad is completely not interested in any of that. Not to belabor the Amy Poehler of it all, but I've always really admired her marriage to Will Arnett. I remember at the Parks and Recreation premiere 4 years ago, Amy was looking for her husband toward the end of the night. She stopped by me and a couple other office writers who had scammed invites to the party. Amy: "Hey guys, have you seen Arnett? I can't find him." We didn't know where he was, and she shook her head good-naturedly like "that guy" and went looking for him. I had never heard a woman call her husband by his last name, like she was a player on the same sports team Will was on. You could tell from that small moment that Will and Amy are pals. Come on, married people. I don't want to hear about the endless struggles to keep sex exciting, or the work it takes to plan a date night. I want to hear that you guys watch every episode of The Bachelorette together in secret shame, or that one got hooked on Breaking Bad, and if either watches it without the other, they're dead meat. I want to see you guys high-five each other like teammates on a recreational softball team you both do for fun. I want to hear about it because I want to know that it's possible, because I want it for myself. I guess I think happiness can come in a bunch of forms, and maybe a marriage with tons of work makes people feel happy. But a part of me still thinks, is it really so hard to make it work? What happened to being pals? I'm not complaining about romance being dead. I've just described a happy marriage as based on talking about plants and a canceled Ray Romano show and drinking milkshakes, not exactly rose petals and gazing into each other's eyes at the top of the Empire State Building or whatever. I'm pretty sure my parents have gazed into each other's eyes maybe once, and that was so my mom could put some eye drops into my dad's eyes. And I'm not saying that marriage should always be easy, but we seem to get so gloomily worked up about it these days. In Shakespearean comedies, the wedding is the end, and there isn't much indication of what happily ever after will look like day to day. In real life, shouldn't a wedding be an awesome party you throw with your great pal in the presence of a bunch of your other friends? A great day, for sure, but not the beginning, and certainly not the end of your friendship with a person you can't wait to talk about gardening with for the next 40 years. Maybe the point is that any marriage is work, but you may as well pick work that you like. Writing this book is work, but it's fun work, and I picked it. And I enjoy doing it with you, listener. It's my job, and it's a job I like. Tim, on the other hand, had chosen a very tough and kind of bad-sounding job, like being the guy who scrapes barnacles off the pylons of an oil rig in the frigid Arctic Sea. Married people, it's up to you. It's entirely on your shoulders to keep this sinking institution afloat. It's a stately old ship, and a lot of people, like me, want to get on board. Please be psyched and convey that psychedness to us. And always remember, so many, many people are envious of what you have. You're the star at the end of the Shakespearean play, wearing the wreath of flowers in your hair. The rest of us are just the little side characters. Why do men put on their shoes so slowly? I have a serious question, and it is a sexist question. But it's a pretty gentle and specific form of a sexist question, so I think it's okay. Why do all men I know put on their shoes so incredibly slowly? When I tie my shoelaces, I can do it standing, and I'm out of the door in about 10 seconds. Or more often, I don't even tie my shoelaces. I slip my feet into my sneakers and I tighten the laces in the car. But with a man, if they are putting on any kind of shoe, sneaker, Vans, dress shoe, it will take 20 times as long as when a woman does it. It has come to the point where if I know I'm leaving a house with a man, I can factor in a bathroom visit or a phone call or both, and when I'm done, he'll almost be done tying his shoes. There's a certain meticulousness that I notice with all guys when they put their shoes on. First of all, they sit down. I mean, they need to sit down to do it. Right there, it signals, I'm gonna be here for a while, let's get settled in. I can put on a pair of hiking boots that have not been laced yet while talking on my cell phone without even leaning on a wall. I don't have any real problems with it, except when you've done a whole snappy slash sexy exit conversation with a guy leaving your place, and then he tacks on an extra 8 minutes as he puts his shoes on. My appearance. The fun and the really not fun. When you're not skinny, this is what people want you to wear. Getting professionally beautified was all that I dreamed about doing when I was an asexual-looking little kid. That's because my parents dressed both my brother and me according to roughly the exact same aesthetic. Bert from Ernie and Bert. Easing them out of dressing me in primary colors and cardigans, seriously, I was a child who wore cardigans, and getting them to let me grow my hair out past my earlobes was the first huge step that took years. So, yeah, now that I'm an adult, getting made beautiful by a team of professionals for a red carpet event or magazine photoshoot is heaven for me. The part that is not fun is someone picking out clothes for me. I love shopping and fashion, as anyone who has heard more than 5 minutes of this will know. But for magazine photoshoots and things, they hire stylists for me, because they have a certain idea for how they want me to look, and it isn't necessarily how I would style myself, which is 1980s-era Lisa Bonet. Since I am not model skinny, but also not super fat and fabulously owning my hugeness, I fall into that nebulous, normal American woman size that legions of fashion stylists detest. For the record, I am a size 8. This week, anyway. Many stylists hate that size, because I think to them it shows that I lack the discipline to be an ascetic, or the confident, sassy abandon to be a total fatty hedonist. They're like, pick a lane. Just be so enormous that you need to be buried in a piano and dress accordingly. For the record, they're not all bad. I've worked with some really badass stylists who make me look so smoking hot your face would melt. Carla Welch, Monica Rose, who style me for the cover of this audiobook, she totally gets my body and celebrates it. Yes, I say things like, celebrates my body, like your old hippie aunt. But many stylists don't know what to do with me. Over the past 7 years, here's what stylists have tried to make me wear. Navy. Ah, navy, the thin-lipped spinster sister of black. Black, though chic and universally slimming, is considered a boring red carpet color and is barely featured on best dress lists. That's why I get shown a lot of navy. Navy has made a comeback in the past few years, which is terrific because before that, Navy was most famous as a signature color for postal workers. Cap sleeves. Cap sleeves look good on no one, and yet I am given them all the time. I believe it is in an effort to hide the flesh where my arm meets my torso, which I guess is disgusting. Cap sleeves should be worn exclusively by toddler flower girls at weddings. Billowing bohemian blouses billed as poet tops. Skinny girls like Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen look ethereal and gorgeous in hippie clothes with lots of volume. I love the bohemian look, but when I try it, I just look like a chubby gypsy. Also, chubby people can never truly pull off ethereal the same way skinny people can never be jolly. The only fat ethereal person I can think of was Anna Nicole Smith, and in her case, ethereal might have meant drugged. Layers of chunky beaded necklaces. Nothing makes me look more like a social worker from the 1970s, like several layers of colorful, conspicuous statement necklaces. Moomoos. In college, I was cast in a student-written musical that was a retelling of a Greek myth. It was a very cool play, with a small cast, each of whom played several roles. The costume designer, an always frowning girl named Stephanie, had us in for a fitting. She gave tight black unitards to every actor, so when they played different roles, they could layer simple costume pieces over them and become the new character. I loved the idea. Then it was my turn to get fitted. I was given an enormous, shapeless black muumuu, held together by a wad of Velcro and tied together with a gold rope. It was obvious it had been made out of the same material as the black canvas curtains of the stage. Stephanie, not a skinny girl herself, by the way, so clearly didn't want to deal with my body. When I complained to the director, he talked to her. She was furious, saying I was a difficult fit. I did not know Stephanie would be the first of many people who would throw a muumuu on me and call it a day. Shawls. I routinely get shawls draped on me, as though I am Queen Elizabeth. A routine injustice done to the non-thin is to make them look like creaky old ladies. Sherlock Holmes-style cloaks. This I don't mind so much, as long as I have a pipe and a monocle. Ponchos. Nothing says, English is not my first language, like me in a poncho. Billowing pants. Once, a stylist for a famous women's fashion magazine dressed me in massive charcoal gray pants with a drawstring. They look like something a sad clown might wear running errands. Maternity tops, billed as Grecian style, are a relative of billowing pants. Daisy print. I think there's something about daisies, or daisy prints, that stylists consider synonymous with cheerful, simple fat woman. Honestly, I feel like some stylists would put me in a hot dog costume and try to convince me that in Paris all the girls were dressing like the Oscar Mayer wiener, just to cover up my body. In 2011, People magazine named me one of the most beautiful English-speaking persons in North America, in a countrywide vote where I just fucking destroyed. But I don't need to remind you of this. You probably have the page torn out and stuck on your fridge as inspiration. In all seriousness, it was an amazing surprise, and I was very flattered and excited. I would even say it was an honor to be singled out for my looks, but I don't think I could, in good conscience, say something that silly in an audiobook that teenage girls might listen to. In case you thought the photo shoot that produced the image in People went seamlessly, pun intended and relished, here's what happened. The photo shoot took place on a Saturday at a public elementary school about an hour away from Hollywood. As I drove there, I got more and more excited, chatting with my mom and promising her I'd send photos. I was set to do the shoot with my Office co-star, Ellie Kemper, who is a close friend and one of my favorite people. A charismatic and almost incomprehensible French stylist took me to the trailer filled with gowns. It was like walking into Saddam Hussein's niece's closet. Organza, tulle, and silk filled the trailer from floor to ceiling. Rhinestones and feathers were everywhere. Each gown was more elaborate and gorgeous than the one before. And they were all size zero. The stylist had not brought any non-samples. The only thing that came close to my size was a shapeless navy shift, which I didn't want to wear because of my aforementioned feelings about navy, and also because it looked like what Judi Dench might wear to the funeral of someone she didn't care that much about. I looked around for other options. There were none. I excused myself by saying I needed to use the bathroom, which, since we were shooting in an elementary school, was the same one the kids used during the day. I went into a stall, sat down on a kid-sized toilet, and cried. Why didn't I just lose 20 pounds so I never had to be in this situation again? Life was so much easier for the actresses who did that. Was my problem that I was this food monster destined to only wear navy shifts? Lots of stupid people were skinny, and yet I couldn't do this incredibly simple thing that they could do with seeming ease. I reached for some toilet paper to wipe my tears, and saw that the dispenser was empty. I sighed and went to the next stall. No toilet paper. I went to another stall. In this stall, there was toilet paper, and there was something else. There was a small amount of excrement smeared on the wall, and next to it, in black Sharpie pen, someone had scrawled, "This school is bullshit." I laughed out loud. Even at this fancy photo shoot, we could not escape the angry, immature graffiti of a mad little kid smearing shit on the wall. I loved this tiny, disgusting rebellion. I don't know why, but it made me feel better. This photo shoot is bullshit, I thought, and went back to the room of gowns. They were steaming the navy gown in anticipation of my arrival. I walked past the stylist and over to the other gowns. I picked my favorite one, an ornate, dusty rose pink gown with a lace train. Me. This is the one I'm gonna wear. Stylist guy. Gently, as if to a fragile idiot.
This will not fit you.
Me. Oh man, then we better get the seamstress to make this one fit, huh? We don't have too much time. Stylist guy.
She is only here for the small alterations, not the large-scale reworking of the gown.
That's when I decided to just pretend as though I somehow had the power, in this weird situation where no one is boss, to end arguments and make decisions. Me. Well, I don't know what to say, because I just don't think I'd feel comfortable in anything but that. When I played the I don't feel comfortable card, he knew it was over. I don't feel comfortable is the classic manipulative girl get my way line. It's right up there with I don't feel entirely safe. Was it fair? Nope. Was it cool? Absolutely not. But it also wasn't fair or cool for him to have brought 3 dozen size zero gowns to my photo shoot. In the end, the seamstress literally cut open the back of one of the gowns and quickly added about a foot of canvas material to the back, pinned it all together, and put it on me. The stylist was near tears at the destruction of the gown, but it fit like a glove. A glove that is kind of ugly and makeshift on the back. But on the front, perfection. I love you, canvas. I love you, safety pins. If I ever do a voice in a Disney movie, where I'm the princess whose friends are a bunch of inanimate household objects who come to life, I hope mine are a swatch of canvas and some sassy safety pins. Later, in our gowns, I took Ellie to the bathroom and showed her the shit-stained graffiti. Ellie loved it, as I knew she would. I spent the rest of the shoot having a blast and posing goofily for photos with my pal, like the awesome, most beautiful, and least dressable girl that I was. These are the narcissistic photos in my BlackBerry. Okay, audiobook listeners. This is the one place in listening to my audiobook where you might have wished you bought the hard copy. And look, I want to encourage you to buy every form of my book possible. But if you don't want to, you can just go to the bookstore and leaf through this essay so you can see some pretty funny photos of me. I'll read you the first part of this essay since you're not going to be able to see the photos. I would rather have someone read my diary than look at my iPod playlists. It's not because I have embarrassing playlists called Setting the Mood for Seduction or Songs to Have Intercourse to. My playlists are humiliating because my workout mixes have insanely dorky titles like You Can Do It, Mindy, and Go For It, Girl. You might also see that some of my playlists are simply 2 songs on repeat 15 times, like I'm a psycho getting pumped up to murder the president. My BlackBerry photos, on the other hand, make me laugh. They are horribly, horribly narcissistic. My BlackBerry camera has proven to exist primarily as a mirror to see if my makeup came out okay. The other photos are of my favorite people who I want to look at all the time. Revenge fantasies while jogging. If it weren't for my imagination, I would weigh 10,000 pounds. This is because the only way I am able to exercise anymore is through a long and vivid revenge fantasy. I'm not talking about revenge on real-life people I know, like, oh, Ed Helms cut me in line at lunch. I'm going to write that his character Andy gets super fat. I'm talking about elaborate Kill Bill-type stories involving people who do not actually exist, where I play the lead role. Because revenge fantasies are such a big part of what I think about when I exercise, I've listed some of my greatest hits. Please integrate these into your own workouts, and say sayonara to calories. My husband is murdered in Central Park on an idyllic spring day. My husband was murdered by a serial killer in Central Park. We were walking by the reservoir one beautiful late spring afternoon eating ice cream cones, and he was suddenly shot in the back of the head by a deranged man wearing an Antonin Scalia mask. Scalia runs away, cackling like the Joker, and hops into an Escalade and peels off. My handsome, innocent husband dies in my arms the very night he was going to host Saturday Night Live for the first time. Oh, yes, in this fantasy, my husband is a star point guard for the team that just won the NBA Finals. They get John Hamm to host a very somber Saturday Night Live that night. I can barely do the cameo I was going to do on Weekend Update. Yes, I still do the cameo. I'm sad, but come on, SNL cameo. Seth Meyers can't muster up the cheerfulness he usually has either. The day's horrible events have marred everything. After my husband's murder, I spend a lot of time doing push-ups and sit-ups, and I cut my hair very short while staring at myself in the mirror with dead eyes. I look like Mia Farrow at her height, but Indian and crazy-toned. I stop enjoying my creature comforts like junk food and hanging out with my friends because nothing brings me pleasure but thoughts of revenge. My best friends give me the hurtful nickname Count of Monte Cristo but boring, because I am bent on revenge and it is getting tedious. However, because of my alienation and obsession, I am able to get into shape pretty fast, because all food tastes the same to me, like nothing. So I eat skinless chicken breasts and broccoli for every meal without complaint. Scalia is in Miami. I find this out from a PI I hired who looks like Kris Kristofferson, but more grizzled. I go down there, hit the Kardashians' Dash Boutique for a hot outfit, then infiltrate the South Beach Club where I know Scalia is hanging out. I am pretending to be a lesbian trainer. Pretty easy to believe, my body is ripped and I have no interest in men anymore. I find Scalia snorting coke in the back room, a lair of sorts. He has framed pictures of all the people he's murdered. I choke him to death with his own mask. When his body goes lifeless in my arms, I'm tempted to pull the mask off to see who it is, but I stop just before I do it. I don't even care anymore. Total time taken up by this fantasy, 12 minutes. Total calories burned while having this fantasy, 90. They kidnap and murder my husband on our honeymoon. My new husband and I are vacationing in Buenos Aires. Some kind of terrorists who focus on interracial marriage, rare I know, but terrible, want to make an example of me and my husband. They kidnap him and hold him for ransom, only to shoot him on live television the next day. At that moment, I stop speaking forever. I am a mute. But a mute who goes to the gym. For I run and do lunges and squats until I have no body fat anymore and I can do 50 chin-ups and 25 pull-ups. Even in my revenge fantasy where all I do is exercise, I can still only do 25 pull-ups. Pull-ups are tough, no joke. I race around Buenos Aires pretending to be a mute Indian tango dancer. But really, I'm trying to find the terrorist who killed my husband, which I do one late summer night. I stab him through the heart with a knife I keep hidden inside my massive hairdo. When caught and put on trial in Argentina, I decide to represent myself. In my closing argument, I say, in the country that saw so many disappearances in the 1970s, I'm surprised that anyone cares about some terrorists disappearing from existence in the present day. Then I disappear. Total time taken up by this fantasy, 8 minutes. Total calories burned while having this fantasy, 65. I get that woman who was rude to me at Saks in trouble. I'm in the Saks Fifth Avenue shoe department. I keep trying to get the attention of a snooty old-school Saks sales lady to try on a pair of Miu Miu pumps. I make the classic mistake of wearing my gym clothes to Saks, so she doesn't pay any attention to me. I finally approach her and flat-out ask for help, and she says she'll be right back. I sit down and wait for almost 10 minutes, and then find out she's helping a rich-looking white woman who is better dressed than me around the corner in the Louboutin section. I am so pissed I go to customer service on the third floor and fill out a complaint card against this woman. Total time taken up by this fantasy, 1 minute. Total calories burned while having this fantasy, 10. Al-Qaeda takes NBC's The Voice hostage. On a big sweeps episode of NBC's The Voice, Al-Qaeda drops from the ceiling on ropes and tries to turn it into a live terrorist competition where they kill innocent people every hour. The really sick part is they make the judges rate each murder. It's unbelievably shocking and horrible. Little did Al-Qaeda know that I was sitting in the second row, having been given VIP tickets by my close personal friend Adam Levine. I have a gun with me in my Alexander McQueen clutch. It's a plastic one that got by the metal detectors, like John Malkovich had in The Line of Fire. I wasn't sure why I packed my gun with me when I was getting ready to go to the taping of The Voice, but now I know. When Al-Qaeda gets ready to shoot their first victim on live TV, we hear a shot ring out. People scream. But no, it's not the innocent person they are about to shoot. It's the terrorist holding the innocent person. I've seen this in movies. The confusing shot ring out move. It is awesome. The terrorists scramble. Who is this invisible anti-terrorist? It's me, Mindy Kaling. I was hiding behind CeeLo's fur coat, and no one saw me. Slowly, over the course of the night, I assassinate every terrorist with my sniper shooting. I train a group of plucky Girl Scouts who are there on a field trip to be a distraction. Soon, the terrorists themselves are filled with terror. Pretty ironical, actually. And then, with the last one gunned down, the SWAT team pours in. I reveal myself and announce, "Song shall never be silenced by terror, only by being voted off." They continue the taping of The Voice, because otherwise, the terrorists would not have won exactly, but would have disrupted our evening of fun song judging. Total time taken up by this fantasy, 20 minutes. Total calories burned, 200. My all-important legacy. Strict instructions for my funeral. Whoever is closest to me when I die, here are the instructions for my funeral. You might think this is presumptuous, but consider it a favor to you, because at the time of my death, you will be so distracted with grief that your ability to plan will be compromised, and I do not want my funeral to be a thrown-together disaster. Thrown Together Disaster Funeral is my new HGTV show. It's a makeover funeral show where three flamboyant gay guys and a judgmental sassy broad, think Wanda Sykes, crash a tacky funeral and fix it. Nuh-uh, everyone out of this church. This funeral is a disaster. Dress code. Chic, devastated. None of my exes are allowed to attend. Distracting, weird. Okay, the only way I would even consider an ex attending is if he was completely, horrifically devastated. Like when he heard I died, it made him take a good, hard look at his life and his choices and he turned Buddhist or something. No current wives or girlfriends of my exes are allowed to attend. This part is really for real non-negotiable. They'll just use the opportunity to look all hot and black. No one can use my funeral as the inciting incident for their own romantic comedy. My a cappella group from college will try to perform. I forgive them for trying, but this is not allowed to happen. I don't just mean the group currently singing at my college. No assembly of past members or anything is allowed to sing. You must be vigilant about this. With a blink of an eye, I can see an entire group of tearful women starting a caterwauling rendition of Sarah McLachlan's I Will Remember You. Be really mindful of this. They will find loopholes. No one may use this occasion to debut original music they wrote. I hate original music. There should be food at my funeral. I hate getting invited to something and there's no food. Something tasteful and light. No pasta, I'm serious. I will climb out of my coffin if anyone brings a baked ziti. Actually, no hot food at all. Small, savory finger sandwiches, scones, coffee. Basically an English tea, but I don't want anything stacked on a tiered platter. That's pretentious. People can text, but no phone calls. It's rude. And when I say you can text, I mean hardcore furtive texting, like using one hand and with your BlackBerry hidden in your purse. If people speak, they need to follow guidelines, or this will become a free-for-all. I have a lot of comedy writer friends. Don't let them turn this into a roast for me. You know how I feel about roasts. I want no moments of mirth at all at this thing. No edgily remembering something stupid I did to show that we can all have a big cathartic laugh. Actually, no catharsis. No irony at all. I mean it. I spent my entire professional career dealing in irony. I want an almost cringe-inducingly earnest ceremony. Please, no religious stuff. I kind of insist that no one mention God or anything at my funeral. I'm not making some big atheist statement, but I want this to be solemn because people are so upset I'm dead, and I don't want to share the spotlight with God. No candles. I hate candles. This isn't a sex scene from Grey's Anatomy. If Steve Carell doesn't show up, I want my children and my children's children to make note of it. There should be a gift bag for people when they leave. Inside of it should include, 1. A photo of me when I was my most beautiful. Put through an old-timey photo process and displayed in a heart-shaped pewter frame. It should look like the kind of photo a soldier carried around with him during the Civil War. 2. An energy bar or trendy body spray from whichever company is sponsoring the funeral. 3. A copy of a drawing I did when I was little of what I wanted to be when I grew up, which was an astronaut. Under the drawing should be written in cursive, "She finally found her wings," or, "And we have liftoff." And 4, a letter from the president talking about my impact on the creative community. If the president happens to be a woman that year, she can slant things that way, how I inspired her to believe in her own dreams and stuff. Do all of this and you will know that I will rest in eternal peace, if that's important to you. My friend, former office writer, and now creator of Parks and Recreation, Mike Schur, supplied me with a eulogy in advance of my death. Thanks, Mike.
A Eulogy for Mindy Kaling by Michael Schur. Friends, members of Mindy's family, representatives of major department stores, good afternoon. My name is Michael Schur, and I worked with Mindy Kaling for several years on the TV program The Office. The American version, not the Chinese version that has been running for the past 41 years. Mindy's sudden death last week shocked me, as I'm sure it also shocked the four women she was fighting over those shoes with during the Dubai Bloomingdale's Midnight Madness sale. Though the stabbing has been labeled accidental, those of us who knew Mindy knew it was only a matter of time before a luxury goods-based brawl would do her in. And if there's a silver lining to all of this, it's that I had, impaled by heel of Christian Louboutin gem suede peep-toe slingback in the How Will Mindy Kaling Die pool that Rainn Wilson has been running since 2006, so I won $200. Thank you. I'll never forget the Mindy Kaling that I met on our first day of work. Bright-eyed, green, a complete novice in the world of television writing, and yet somehow far more confident than everyone else. She was supremely confident. Braggy, maybe. Cocky? What's the right word? Let's go with talgy, which is a word I just made up that means talkative and braggy. Her work ethic was second to none, and by that I mean if you made a list of all of the levels of work ethics, hers would be just above none. One day she came into work so late it was the next morning, and for that morning she was also late, and hungover. But we forgave her because when we tried to bring it up, she just started talking about how hot some actor was, and how much she loved Italian ice, and then how Beyonce should release a country album, and then a bunch of other boring stuff, and we got tired and just forgot about the whole thing. Mindy wore a lot of hats. Ivy League graduate, actor, comedian, playwright, inveterate gossip, weirdly pro-gun Republican, outspoken advocate of conspicuous consumption, and of course, as we learned upon the posthumous release of her puffy sticker-covered diaries, hardcore pervert. But despite all of these foibles and flaws, and the literally thousands of others I jotted down in my psychotherapist-mandated Mindy workbook in order to maintain a sense of professionalism while we worked together, I loved Mindy Kaling. No one wrote like Mindy. No one was funnier than Mindy. No one else, in short, was Mindy. This will not be true for long, I understand, as her will dictates that her DNA be replicated 1 million times, news that recently sent the NYSE Retail Shopping Index skyrocketing. I can't believe she's gone. I console myself by thinking, well, I guess the angels just wanted her to shut the hell up. I will miss her dearly, and I hope that she is up in heaven right now watching us and smiling, even though deep down I know that if there is an afterlife, she's a pretty much open and shut case for hell. Rest in peace.
Goodbye. When I was 6 and I saw The Sound of Music for the first time, my favorite part, hands down, was when the Von Trapp children bid farewell to partygoers with their song, "So Long Farewell," from the stairway of their Austrian manor. As an adult, I now see what a terrible example this is for children. It teaches them that adults will be charmed by long, protracted musical goodbyes. In fact, all of The Sound of Music inspired a childhood's worth of my misguided behavior, where I believed people would always be excited to hear me sing. I memorized the song off a record player. Then, at bedtime, I called my parents to the landing of the stairs in our house so that I could perform it in its entirety. Just me singing all 7 kids' parts, accompanied by no music. Once I finished one child's part, I exited, then ran down the stairs again to pick up the next one's part. My parents listened patiently until we got to the second kid's exit. Okay, enough of this, my dad said, and headed up the stairs to shuffle me up to bed. We're only on Friedrich. There are 5 more Von Trapp children, I said. This fell on deaf ears. My parents were supportive of my creativity, but did not have a lot of patience for whimsy with zero production value. They had stuff to do. The point is, I learned nothing from this experience. Yes, if I'm at a party where I'm not enjoying myself, I will put some cookies in my jacket pocket and leave without saying goodbye. But when I'm having a great time, I like them nice and drawn out, Von Trapp style. I could say goodbye all day long, like a guy putting on his shoes. Before I leave, I thought I'd answer any remaining questions you might have.
So you never won any childhood spelling bees? I was under the impression this was a memoir of a spelling bee champ.
It is confusing, I know. Based on my ethnicity, the number of friends I had as a kid, my build, my eyesight, and my desire to please my parents, I should have been the reigning spelling bee champion from ages 7 to 14. My best guess at an explanation is that my parents were worried I would be just too good a speller and a potential kidnap prospect for anyone watching the Scripps National Spelling Bee on C-SPAN 3 in the middle of the afternoon.
Why didn't you talk about whether women are funny or not?
I just felt that by commenting on it in any real way, it would be tacit approval of it as a legitimate debate, which it isn't. It would be the same as addressing the issue of, should dogs and cats be able to care for our children? They're in the house anyway. I try not to make it a habit to seriously discuss nonsensical hot-button issues.
What will your next book be about?
I hope my next book will be about my husband, my kids, my cool movie career, and sharing all the things I learned about since I wrote this book. Like, I'd love to know where my natural lip line is. I still have no clue. Maybe by then I'll have figured it out.
Anything else?
No, not really. I don't want to say goodbye. See you guys soon. Love, Mindy. This is Mindy Kaling. Is everyone hanging out without me? And other concerns. By Mindy Kaling. With additional voices by BJ Novak, Michael Schur, and Brenda Withers. Thanks, guys. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt. Producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2011 by Mindy Kaling. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.